Well, this morning our exposition of Ecclesiastes brings us to a new chapter, and so I invite you to open with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Preachers are not supposed to talk about politics from the pulpit, but today I'm going to anyway. And it's not because I particularly want to comment on the results of this week's election. I'm actually tired of the election and this whole process. The reason is that in the providence of God, the very next passage in our series in Ecclesiastes actually has to do with what we call politics. And I promise you, I did not plan it that way. It just worked out as the Lord has led in the timing of these various Sundays. And it's also encouraging to me that what this passage highlights is very much along the lines of what Philip touched on when he read that section from Titus chapter 3. We want to be sure we connect this chapter with what's gone on before. And as we have seen a number of times in Ecclesiastes, Solomon will alternate between the theme that wisdom is limited in its ability to interpret, to bring us to an understanding. Wisdom has limitations. So he alternates between that kind of negative theme and the positive theme that nevertheless wisdom really does have considerable benefits as far as living in the world that we have before us. And so you may remember that at the end of chapter 7 there was this emphasis that God's ways are mysterious. We cannot fully probe them. And last week especially, that human nature is mysterious, and we can hardly understand other human beings, and sometimes not even ourselves. No amount of wisdom is going to probe the depths of the mysteries that we have encountered in this book of Ecclesiastes. But that does not mean that we should not pursue wisdom, that there is not some level of wisdom that we can attain, that we shouldn't strive to probe what is happening around us and to make the best possible choices with the circumstances that we are handed by the providence of God. And that's what chapter 8 is going to get into. It's going to revisit, in general, the idea of the benefits of wisdom. And it begins with a transitional statement along those lines. Look with me at verse 1. Who is like the wise? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. Now that general statement about wisdom and its value, and kind of an invitation here once again to seek wisdom, it would have relevance for a lot of different areas of life, but when you come to verse 2, you find that Solomon is narrowing the discussion down to a particular sphere of life in which wisdom is so critical. And look at how verse 2 starts. He says, I say, keep the king's command. He's going to talk about the relationship that people ought to strive for as it relates to the civil authorities in that day. In that day, it would have been a monarchy. It would have been a king. And he's going to get into some detail about this aspect of life that he has touched on somewhat earlier, how to respond to those who are in civil government over us. That emphasis is actually going to continue at least till verse 9. If you look at verse 9 with me, it says, all this, looking back at what he has said so far, all this I observed, while applying my heart to all that is done under the sun, when man had power over man to his hurt. So he's still talking about human authority, one man having power over another man. And he acknowledges that the way that works, probably more often than we would desire to see, is that people in those positions of civil authority are actually abusing their authority. And so some of what he's going to say is going to relate to that kind of scenario in particular. And so this morning our text is verses 1 through 9. And our theme is responding wisely to civil authorities. Responding wisely to civil authorities. And I'm going to try to summarize the wisdom in this passage with three imperatives. The first one is in verse 1, and it is one that, as Philip suggested this morning, we find particularly challenging, especially when things don't go our way as far as civil government is concerned. Here is God's wisdom for those kinds of life experiences. Simply be gracious. That's the imperative that is implied by the statements of verse 1, be gracious. And it begins with these questions, right? Who is like the wise and who knows the interpretation of a thing? By bringing this topic up in question form, he is implying that those kind of people, people that have wisdom, especially to navigate this area of life, those kind of people are pretty rare. But that this passage is going to help us all to move in that direction. And surely Solomon, who was Israel's wisest king, would have something helpful for us to say, something accurate. He would be qualified to guide us in this particular area. And when he says, who knows the interpretation of a thing, it may well be that he is alluding to an earlier descendant of Abraham by the name of Joseph. And I'm going to read to you a few verses here from the story of Joseph in Genesis chapter 41, where he is before Pharaoh, and in the providence of God, he is given this opportunity, really under pressure, to interpret this dream of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh says to Joseph in verse 15, I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I have heard said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. And Joseph said to Pharaoh, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. The word interpret that shows up there in a couple cases is very similar to the word interpretation in this particular passage. And it may be an allusion, bringing that whole scenario to mind, where Joseph is in front of a powerful civil ruler, unsure of what to do, not knowing what to make of this dream and how to respond in this pretty tense situation. And he nevertheless is confident that God is going to help him. God has the wisdom to give the interpretation. Not that any of us would probably be in those exact circumstances, but it is pointing us to the need to interpret political scenarios and experiences that we have with those in authority, and of casting ourselves on the Lord to know how to respond wisely. That's the note that he starts out on. And actually, even the statement at the beginning, who is like the wise, with that in mind, reminds you of some other statements later from Pharaoh. When God gave Joseph the interpretation, here was Pharaoh's response. Can we find a man like this? Who is like the wise? Can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. Same terminology that you find here in Ecclesiastes 8:1. We understand Joseph was a unique case, and yet there is something to be learned from him. And from how Solomon seems to be bringing his experience to the surface here regarding how we ought to interact with our authority. And then he goes on to say at the second part of verse 1, a man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. You know what he's talking about there? He's talking about what we today would call nonverbal communication. He's talking about the appearance of your face and how your face, particularly when you're before an authority, speaks volumes and can actually have an impact on how you are received. Your gestures, your facial expressions, other forms of nonverbal communication. I was amused here this week. I saw a little clip on CNN that was analyzing the first conversation that President Obama had with Donald Trump. And this particular clip, the individual, I don't know if she was a psychologist or what she was, but It was all about interpreting the body language and what it suggested about the relationship between these two and kind of what we can expect going forward. So, for example, she was looking at the current president and noted that for about the first minute and a half of this conversation, he was not really looking at Donald Trump. He was kind of speaking to the air and said, this is kind of an awkward or difficult or interesting way to start a conversation that you're not really looking at the individual eye to eye. And then she said he was moving his eyelids up and down very slowly, like he wasn't blinking. It was like he was processing what was being said. And she said that when people in conversation move their eyelids up and down slowly, that means that they're not particularly amenable to what is being said, and they're sort of groping for how to deal with it. Then she looked at Trump, and she noticed that he had his hands put together like this in kind of a triangle. And she said that suggests a feeling of superiority and power in a relationship. And she said, now, most of the time he had his hands like this, but down here, which implies that even though you feel superior, you're trying to be respectful toward the other person. She said, now, if somebody has their hands like this and puts them up here toward their chest, and definitely if they were to put them up here over their head like a crown, then that's like an in-your-face insult, you know, I got a leg up on you or something like that. Well, I almost called Janine to ask her if she could interpret all of this stuff for me, but I don't know how much stock to put into that sort of thing. But we understand the significance of nonverbal communication. Our facial expressions not only suggest what we're thinking, but they also have an effect on how we are perceived and how we are received by other people. And now for the rest of the message, I'm going to be very self-conscious of how I look. Anyway, Solomon is talking here about how wisdom positively affects your bearing and the way you come across, particularly when you're dealing with authorities. What does he mean when he says a man's wisdom makes his face shine? I would imagine that that is best understood in terms of the concept of a face shining, which occurs in other places in the Old Testament, and particularly in the Aaronic benediction of Numbers chapter 6. Remember these beautiful words? The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you, and then listen to this right away, and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. In other words, the idea of somebody's face radiating, that is associated with a favorable disposition, in the case of God, with a blessing and with a spirit of graciousness toward the person. Look at the next part. It says, and the hardness of his face, though it might start off kind of hard and angry and upset, wisdom actually changes your countenance, particularly as you interact with an authority. The fact is that when it comes to our civil authorities, we often have cause to be dissatisfied and even angry. And frankly, sometimes a strong reaction is appropriate. Yeah, think, for example, of the preaching of John the Baptist and how sometimes, sent by God in that setting, he very bluntly confronted the sins of both the civil and the religious authorities. He didn't pull any punches. He didn't smooth anything over. There was a lot of, as it were, negativity about his preaching. Yet, what can happen when our anger is such and the hardness of our face is such that that is the main thing that people see so much that they actually lose what we're trying to say and the cause that we're trying to defend. It actually becomes a judgment call when you're in a setting like that to determine what would be the best way to interact. If it should be a direct confrontational approach, and being very blunt about the depths of your feelings, or if it should be a kind and gentle and almost understated response out of an effort to be more effective and to be more appealing to the person that you're dealing with. In this case, the hard face points to very strong negative emotions, where your initial instinct is to just blurt out whatever is on your mind and to almost blow up with your sense of dissatisfaction. And yet you start to think about it and your wisdom, guided by God, kind of takes over those emotions, and it actually softens you the way you go about it. It actually makes you gentle and therefore more compelling in the content of what you're trying to get across. As you ponder what is going to be most conducive to people listening to you, you recognize the need to settle down and, by God's grace, to be as winsome as possible. Now, I think we can take this on into other passages and recognize that in other places of the Bible, the same point is being made. Listen to how the Apostle Peter in New Testament times is going to counsel New Testament believers who are beginning to face persecution from those in authority over them. He says in 1 Peter 2:17, "Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor." I thought about that. It's just an amazing statement that really in the same breath, in the same verse, he can on the one hand say honor or fear God. In other words, worship God, submit to God, be committed to God's ways. And yet on the other hand, say honor the emperor. Do everything you can to show a gracious, respectful, kind, and gentle spirit. That would have been such a difficult thing in this particular setting in the first century, because as far as the Romans were concerned, the emperor was a god. He was elevated almost to a status of deity, and people actually did worship him. And yet somehow it was possible, according to Peter, to fear God on the one hand and stay loyal to him, and yet honor somebody who thought he was a god and who lived a terribly immoral life. How do you do that? I think wisdom, guided by the Holy Spirit, enables you actually to do that. Somehow it is possible to honor the true God and yet give an appropriate honor to the emperor. Now, I'm sure we can think of a lot of applications. And I'm going to close this morning with some general application thoughts, but here's something pretty specific. When he speaks here of wisdom, as you are interacting with authorities, particularly about things that are hard to accept and efforts you're making to change or improve the situation, and he says that wisdom makes you a compelling, winsome, gracious person, do you think that there's any relevance of this truth to the way that we interact online regarding politics? Do you think there's any application or any connecting of the dots that we should be able to make as far as our posting when it comes to civil authority is concerned? Does our manner help our cause, or does it actually end up turning people off? And you want to remember what Solomon said in another place. This is Proverbs 15:2. The tongue of the wise commends knowledge. In other words, it makes it attractive. You're not only saying the right thing, but you're saying it in such a way that people are attracted to it. And here's what Jesus said about this in Matthew 10:16. He said, "Behold, I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves." And I think what Solomon is getting at is that in our interactions when it comes to authority, there is this mix of the right position and even the effort to make changes, but you are very gracious and you are very careful and you look for ways to make this appealing. So be gracious. That's the first imperative. Number two, and getting really to the heart of this passage, he teaches us, starting in verse 2, to be submissive. To be submissive to our civil authorities. And in verse 2 and down through about verse 5, you're going to find several ways in which he is encouraging this duty of submission to civil authority. In fact, this is so much the case that we could call Ecclesiastes chapter 8 the Romans 13 of the Old Testament. Listen to these commands to submit. There at the beginning of chapter 2, it is most blunt. He just says flat out, keep the king's command. Keep the king's command. Romans 13:1 is just as blunt when it says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. Now, right away, we need to say that those kinds of statements have to be qualified biblically. We understand that when the government directly tells us to disobey a law of God, our response ought to be what the response of the disciples was in Acts 5:29, that we must obey God rather than men, and at that point as well be willing to suffer whatever the consequences may be for taking that position. And yet when you look at the whole of Scripture, it's really hard to conclude that that is basically the standard attitude that people should have toward government. Civil disobedience is presented in the Bible as highly exceptional. And typically, we're not dealing in our day with such stark conflicts that demand that sort of response. The main tone of Scripture is the effort to submit. And he says it a little bit different way in verse 3 at the beginning. He says, be not hasty to go from the presence of the king. What is he getting at there when he says, don't hurry to get away from his presence? Like if you happen to have some kind of audience with the king, don't try to get out of there in a hurry. Why would you try to get out of there in a hurry? Let me have you turn to chapter 10 and verse 4, which I believe is a kind of commentary or explanation on this part. And it says in Ecclesiastes 10:4, if the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. I love that verse. And it has so many applications beyond just dealing with kings and authorities. Calmness will lay great offenses to rest. Don't lash out. Don't do what maybe comes to your mind right away instinctively. Don't try to get out of there. If he is angry, if he is opposing you, look for positive ways that you can actually show support. And then also in verse 3, Solomon says, do not take your stand in an evil cause. Which is probably referring to an all-out effort to overthrow the government. And out-and-out rebellion, or what we would call a coup. And so you have those commands to submit that do sound like Romans 13, but just like Romans 13, you also have a lot of motivations or reasons that Solomon uses to encourage that sort of response. And look back at verse 2. Right after he says, keep the king's command, he says, because of God's oath to him. I think that probably is the way to translate this expression. And what is it talking about? God made an oath to the king. It may be specifically that Solomon is thinking of the covenant or the oath that God made with the descendants of David to establish them in the throne of Israel. They were divinely appointed, and because God is the one who put them there, therefore you keep the king's command. Whether or not it's referring to the Davidic covenant, that is the thrust. Nevertheless, this individual is there having been ordained by God. And therefore, you keep the king's command, not because you're so much thinking he's a wonderful person, but because of who put him in that position. And then on to verse 3, right after he says that you should not go hastily from his presence or take your stand in an evil cause. He says, for he, the king, does whatever he pleases. For the word of the king is supreme or authoritative. And who may say to him, what are you doing? God, having put him in that position, actually has given him a great deal of authority. And Romans 13, once again, has the same motivation. For there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists what God has appointed. Verse 5 has this encouragement about our submission. When at the beginning it says, whoever keeps a command will know no evil thing. And probably in that statement, the word evil is not referring to something morally evil, though that's true. If you don't get involved in an evil cause, you're not going to know the evil. But often this word evil actually is referring to something bad in a more general sense. In other words, trouble, as some translations would put it. You're not going to know trouble. You're not going to suffer bad consequences, i.e. you're not going to be punished by the government for having submitted when that is what God calls you to do. And to quote Romans 13 one more time, he says as well, and those who resist will incur judgment, for rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Submit. And those are the reasons why. Now, submission is not anybody's favorite pastime. Nobody likes to submit, particularly to governing authorities, especially when we don't respect them as people, especially when we think their demands are unwise or unreasonable, especially when submitting is going to incur some personal cost to ourselves. And in those cases, so long as we're not being commanded to do something against the law of God, both Ecclesiastes 8 and Romans 13 have challenged us to obey anyway. Not because we admire the individuals in authority, not because we agree with them, but actually because of our highest allegiance, because of our allegiance to our Creator. We are citizens of two kingdoms. I hope you view yourself in that way. A member, first of all, of the kingdom of God, and secondly, in some human government under some authority, expressing your membership in the kingdom of man as well. And we understand that those two things are often in conflict. Those two things have different values. Those two things are pulling in different directions. And yet here's the irony. We actually show our loyalty to the heavenly kingdom by submitting to the sometimes unwise demands and sometimes foolish leaders of the earthly kingdom. You might think, well, I'm going to display my submission to God as my king by going as fast as I can in the different direction from my earthly king. Actually, it doesn't work that way. Again, unless they are commanding us to disobey God, the way we show our loyalty to the heavenly kingdom is actually by submitting to the earthly kingdom. And in fact, according to 1 Peter, what makes our testimony for Christ compelling is precisely the effort that we make, despite the tensions with the earthly kingdoms, the effort that we make to submit whenever possible to human authorities. Listen to 1 Peter chapter 2. He says, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme, or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good... And he's justifying doing good in that context as being subject to every human institution. That by doing that good specifically, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover up for evil, but living as servants of God. There does not have to be a tension between being a servant of God and submitting to my civil authority. Actually, when I recognize the sovereignty of God regarding the governors he's put before me, and I make an effort to submit to them as much as biblically possible, I'm actually commending the gospel. I'm actually commending the gospel. What gives the gospel a bad name is for people to be revolutionary. It is for people to be constantly criticizing and lashing out and making fun of and slandering the human authorities. It is my effort to be as respectful and submissive as possible that actually is the thing that commends God and his gospel to people. So be submissive. Number three, and finally, the end of this passage would teach us this word of wisdom about relating to our civil authorities, and that is be patient. Be gracious, be submissive, and be patient. Patient in a couple ways here. First of all, patient in waiting for the best opportunity to appeal to authorities. And listen to verse 5 at the middle. It says that the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. For there is a time and a way for everything, although man's trouble lies heavy on him. For he does not know what is to be, for who can tell him how it will be? Remember that famous passage back in chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes that said there's a time for this, and there's a time for that, and there's a time for this, and there's a time for that. And it ends by saying God has made everything beautiful or appropriate or fitting in its time. And what these verses add to that is that there is also in the plan of God a proper time and an appropriate procedure for working with our authorities to address whatever concerns we have. That's what he's getting at when he says the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. We don't always know when that is going to be. And it's challenging to wait for that right moment. He acknowledges that you cannot predict when you're going to have that opportunity. And he acknowledges that while you wait, your trouble may lie heavy on you. You may well suffer a great deal while you're in this waiting mode. But the point is, wait until in the sovereign timing of God, you are given the opportunity to graciously address the concerns. We're talking about wisdom. And what he is teaching is that wisdom is going to include, number one, waiting on God's timing. Number two, knowing how to read God's providence to know if now is the time to act or if I should keep waiting. And number three, figuring out the most effective procedure possible when that time should come. And as I think about wisdom helping in those ways, I really can't help think again of Christ when he was standing his trial before actually both the religious authorities and the civil authorities. There is such a wise mixture of, on the one hand, silence. Sometimes he didn't answer their questions. He just let it go, didn't respond at all. And they were stunned that he wasn't defending himself. Other times he responded, but it tended to be just like little one-liners. Sometimes by throwing a question back at them. Sometimes by making a theological statement. But always in a spirit of humility, entrusting himself into the hands of God. There was this incredible wisdom and patience in how he responded. And back again in 1 Peter, we read this. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but he continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you've been healed. For you were straying like sheep, but you've now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. And he moves on in those last couple verses to talk about our salvation. And what he is saying is, look at the eternal, spiritual, life-changing benefits that accrued to you because of the fact that Jesus responded in such a wise way to his authorities. Because he did not fight back, and because he was so measured in his responses, and because he was submissive to the situation God had him in, because of that, your soul was saved. Which is encouraging to us about all the good that may come as we follow the same kind of patient approach. So we are encouraged here to be patient in waiting for the best opportunity to appeal to our authorities. And then finally, we are encouraged to be patient in waiting for God himself to deal with those authorities. Look especially at verse 8. It says, no man has power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death. The word power shows up there twice. The first time it is a term that is translated rulers, as in city rulers, back in chapter 7 and verse 19. The second one comes from the same root, and it is translated supreme in chapter 8 and verse 4. I believe Solomon would have us keep all these usages of the words for power or rule or authority connected together. And here is the connection as he gets there to verse 8. Human rulers, they in God's plan have a great deal of power or authority. They may make your life miserable. They may dictate your circumstances to a great degree. But he goes on to say here now, here is an area that human rulers have no authority over. They don't have authority over their own spirit as to when they're going to die and that spirit is going to go to the next world. There is an area that God unilaterally controls, not using human rulers, but God alone has authority over their death. And the point is, look, God is well able to take care of these abusive powers. These people may be strong, heavy-handed rulers. They don't rule the day of their death. And he goes on to say at the end of verse 8, there is no discharge from war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. As he's talking about death, the idea is that the God who controls death, right, thinking about these rulers who are typically in this culture men of warfare, God is sovereign over the warfare. He may use that to take their lives. The wickedness there has to do with the wicked rulers that you may be suffering under. They're not going to be able to deliver themselves when God says, all right, you're going to die in this battle here. Your time has come. He's going to judge those evil rulers. And whether he uses warfare or something else, we're being assured here, God is going to bring these people to justice one day. And Solomon ends by sharing with us that in his own life, he had seen that justice worked out before. All this, verse 9, all this I observe while applying my heart to all that is done under the sun, when man had power over man to his hurt. He looks back and he says, I've observed this. I'm not just theorizing here. These ideas about how to deal with your rulers and these ideas about how God deals with your rulers, I've seen it with my own eyes. And whether we see it in our lifetime or not, we ought to be instructed by this testimony that God is a God of justice. That he is the rock. That his work is perfect. That all his ways are justice. A God of faithfulness and without iniquity, just and upright is he. Now, as we close, let me share with you these points of application. You know, one thought that struck me as I reflected here on keeping the king's command and all of this. I'm just thankful I don't live under a monarchy. you know, that's one point I take away from this. In other words, for as bad as I may have it, my life has never been nearly as difficult as what this passage is describing. In fact, that's one of the hard things about some of these verses. You find it hard to apply because your circumstances are so different. We have so many liberties and so many opportunities, and God has blessed us historically with many great and wise leaders. And even under bad leaders, He continues to bless us with privileges and opportunities. I think that whenever we're tempted to whine about whatever right or preference is being taken away from us, we ought to go back to a passage like this and we ought to just say, look, I've never had it this bad. God has been incredibly kind to me. I hardly know how to apply some of these things because my situation is so much better. So be thankful. Number two, by the power of the Spirit, let us live out the principles of this passage in whatever contact we may have with the government that we do live under, whether it's a king or somebody else. Be gracious, be submissive, be patient. Number three, as I have mentioned already this past week, I think we ought to pray that believers who are involved directly in government would be enabled to interact in these ways with their superiors. And their superiors that they may have some real tensions with as far as their worldview and their lifestyle and their way of ruling. There are still Christian people that God has thrust into that environment. I think we've got some great prayer requests on behalf of Governor Pence here and other Christians in those circles, that they would know how to be gracious and appropriately submissive and patient. Number four, apply these principles about authority to authorities in your life beyond just the government. I think these truths have relevance across the board in all kinds of authority structures. In fact, thinking again about 1 Peter, it hit me how he carries this out into other relationships. And for example, in chapter 3, where he's talking not about the government, he's talking to wives who are married to unsaved husbands. And he's saying these same kinds of things. Be gracious, be submissive, be patient. If there's any hope for anything to be done to fix the problem you're in your marriage, it's not going to be by you lashing out and getting really angry. That's going to hurt the cause. Be gracious, be submissive, be patient. This is what Peter's instructing to wives in that setting. And this applies to children and the authority of their parents. And this applies to employees and the authority of their employers. And this applies to students and the authority in their school, whatever the structure is. God's truth is relevant across the board. And finally, as we are reminded here, and in some cases discouraged by, the realities of life in a fallen world, let the problems that we may face with authorities heighten our anticipation for the coming of the perfect King, the King of Kings. Someday, nobody's going to have to say, just humble yourself. I know he's a terrible person. I know he's abusing his authority. I know he's not wise. Be patient. God will honor you. God will vindicate. Someday nobody's going to have to say that anymore, because that's not the way the king is going to be. The king is going to be Isaiah chapter 11. He's going to have the spirit of wisdom and understanding and counsel and might and knowledge and the fear of the Lord. He's not going to judge by what his eyes see or decide dispute by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he's going to judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist and faithfulness the belt of his loins. This week on Veterans Day, I called Mr. Holmes to thank him for serving our country. And he did most of the talking. And what he kept saying as he was reflecting on his experiences and on this country and all the problems and the election is, we just need Jesus to come back. That's what's on his heart. And I think that is a good word for us. As we look at this passage and dwell on authority, we have a much better kingdom to look forward. And may the Lord Jesus come soon.